Let's turn back to where we were last week then. This is the class that's covering the book of Revelation. We've got to the middle of the book, roughly. Last week we began to work our way into chapter 12. Today we'll be covering what remains of chapter 12 and the whole of 13, and I don't know whether we'll get any further than that. We'll see what we can do. I'm going to try to pick up the pace a little bit so we don't get too bogged down. It's appropriate that we take up this matter on November 12th, worldwide day of prayer for the persecuted church, because that is kind of what this section of the book of Revelation has to do with. We've already met the beast briefly in chapter 11. Back in chapter 11, we were told in verse 7 that when the two witnesses representing the church of the last days, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that ascends from the bottomless pit or the abyss will make war upon them and conquer them and kill them. The beast comes up out of the depths of the earth to wreak havoc and make war with the saints of God. Today we're going to be looking, let's start with Revelation 12, verse 13. We'll just read the story without lots of comment on the details of it, because it leads directly into the consideration of the two beasts outlined for us in chapter 13. But this is what we informally call the Antichrist figure. This is the first real meeting we've had in this book with this figure, although there have been hints along the way pointing towards his advent. So verse 13 of chapter 12, when the dragon, remember we were introduced last week to a great portent in heaven, a red dragon with seven heads and 10 horns that makes war in heaven against Michael and his angels. Actually, it's Michael and his angels who go forth against the dragon to cast him down. So at this point in the narrative, the dragon has lost that heavenly battle, finds himself remanded to the earthly plane. And so when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had borne the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. There's that 3.5-year period that we've met in several forms, 42 months, 1,260 days. Here it's a time, times, and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river which the dragon had poured from his mouth. And then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems upon its horns and a blasphemous name upon its heads. I wanted to get 13:1 in there so that we see how the narrative just carries right through across the chapter division, which probably isn't in a very happy place, once again, in this book. So the picture is that of the dragon being angry because he lost a battle in heaven, and so directly he goes after the woman. We saw last week she represents the historic people of God rooted in Israel from the Old Testament period, and God's choice of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right down through the time of the birth of Christ and into John's time, into the time when this prophecy is being written. So we have to picture the people of God as this succession of generations of believers, and the people of God are represented by the celestial woman who is now persecuted by the serpent or the dragon. But the earth comes to the help of the woman, and so she suffers no harm. After all, we were told up in verse 6 of chapter 12, the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which to be nourished for 1,260 days. So God preserves this woman. Probably, that's all typological imagery drawn from the Old Testament, in the same way that God delivered the Israelites from the threat of Egypt. Egypt, who is represented as a monster or a dragon in the Psalms, as Rahab, who attacked the people of God, but God came to the help of Israel. There are even little details like this one. We're not going to try to pull up every one of these just for time's sake, but it's worth it to see one or two of these things. For example, way back in Exodus 19, where the Israelites have been taken out of Egypt and drawn into the wilderness, where God is going to look after them, sending manna to help them, and so forth. Notice this language in verses 3 and 4. This is Exodus 19, 3 and 4. Moses went up to God. God said, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings." I bore you on eagle's wings. It's as though God swooped down like an eagle and scooped up Israel and lifted them out of their oppression in Egypt and carried them into the wilderness where God is going to take care of them. And that's exactly the image then that John picks up on when he says in verse 14 of Revelation 12, the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness. So this is all typological use of Old Testament language representing God's protection of the people of God. But although the woman is preserved, the woman who represents the church corporate, notice in verse 17, that the dragon, seeing that he could do nothing to the woman, decides he's going to go off and make war on the rest of her offspring. He was ready to spring and devour Jesus when he was born early in the chapter. And now the dragon goes off to make war on the rest of her offspring, those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus. In other words, individual believers are exposed to this dragon, even though the woman is protected. Well, what shall we make of this duality? Go back with me into the words of Jesus, and I hope this might shed just a little bit of light on it. In Matthew 16, Jesus says two things. They seem like opposites in a way. In Matthew 16, verse 18, we have this wonderful promise that Jesus left with his church. "I tell you, your name is Rock." He's talking about Peter. Peter has just confessed Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of God. And so Jesus comes back and says to him, "I tell you, you are Petros, Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the powers of death," or a more literal translation, "the gates of Hades, the gates of hell itself, shall not prevail against it." So all the way to the end of time, Jesus promises to be with his church. Hell might unloose against the church all its worst, and yet the gates of Hades will not prevail. The church will be built. Just go down a few verses, however, and notice that in Matthew 16:24, Jesus says almost the opposite thing. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. The possibility of martyrdom is raised just after Jesus says, my church will be built. That duality is what the book of Revelation is representing when it says God preserves the woman in the wilderness. I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. But then the beast comes up out of the sea and unleashes its fury against the rest of the woman's offspring. And Jesus says, whoever saves his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. And so if we can point right now to what is going to be the central exhortation in our text for this morning, go down to chapter 13, verse 9. At this point, the seer of the apocalypse breaks in his description of the beasts, and he throws in this, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. Because we have to remember the whole purpose of the book of Revelation is that it should be read and we should keep what's written in it. It's not given to us simply to satisfy curiosity about an eschatological timetable. It's given to us to spur us into the kind of faithful action and faithful witness that's demanded of the people of God as pressure increases. And so if anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone slays with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. So the whole purpose of our passage is to summon forth from us faith and to prepare us for endurance. And by the way, this is the same duality that we saw back in chapter 11 in a different set of imagery again, where John was told, he was given a reed and told, rise and measure the temple of God. This is in verses 1 and 2. Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there, but do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it's given over to the nation. Same idea. God preserves the inner sanctum while allowing the courts to be trampled. Protection, yet exposure. Protection of the corporate reality of the church. Exposure of individuals in the church to these forces of evil. Now let's put on the table all three of the members of this unholy trinity. John has already introduced the dragon who tries to rival God. And now in chapter 13, we're introduced in full to the beast. So we'll read verse 1 again. I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems upon its horns and a blasphemous name upon its heads. Just compare that verse with the way the dragon was described back in 12:3. A great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems upon his heads. In both cases, we have a 7-headed and 10-horned creature. In the one case, the 7 heads have the crowns on them. 7 heads are mentioned first in the case of the dragon, and they have golden crowns on them. Then follow the 10 horns. Now, in the case of the beast that comes up out of the sea, John reverses that order. He names the 10 horns first, and then the 7 heads, and he puts the crowns on, or the 10 diadems upon those 10 horns, indicating that the dragon and the beast are intimately related to each other, and yet there's a difference of emphasis. Verse 2 is the one that's going to throw us back into the book of Daniel. I've put on the board, we're going to have to do a rapid review of the whole of the book of Daniel in order to appreciate what John is doing in Revelation 13. So a really fast overview today. The beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, its mouth was like a lion's mouth, and to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. So there, John is doing what he typically does, reaches back into the Old Testament and mines out of that quarry some images, some language that we're supposed to pick up on. We're supposed to know the Old Testament like the back of our hand, just like John does, so that this will just ring with us. Actually, in fact, we all have to work a little bit harder because we didn't probably grow up in a Jewish culture in which this was drummed into us from childhood in detail. So, going back to the book of Daniel, you know, Daniel lived kind of between the Babylonian and the Medo-Persian empires. I haven't bothered to put the years there, but in antiquity, there was an actual succession of empires. Daniel lived at a time when the Jewish exile in Babylonia was coming to an end. And he read in the book of Jeremiah the prophecy that says, you're going to have 70 years of exile, and then there's going to be a restoration. So as Daniel studied the books of prophecy, he realized he was living toward the end of that 70-year period of exile. And he thought, because he didn't have our perspective, he couldn't look back on history the way we do. He was looking forward to a number of these things. And so he thought, at least until the angel Gabriel was sent to him to reveal more, Daniel thought maybe the end of the world is just around the corner. God's timetable of prophecy is coming to its end. We sinned as a nation. God allowed us, Jews, to be carried into exile in Babylonia. We've now fulfilled our 70 years, all those years of Sabbaths that we failed to observe as a nation. And now we're getting toward the end of it. And so the angel Gabriel was sent from heaven to Daniel to tell him, no, the end of the world isn't actually right around the corner. You're not going to live to see it. In fact, the 70 years are going to become 70 times 7. Daniel chapter 9, it all stretches out and becomes something much more complicated. And it's revealed to Daniel the Jewish people are actually going to have to be oppressed by a whole succession of pagan empires. So in chapter 2 of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, given this dream one night where he sees a statue with a head of gold and a chest of silver and arms of silver and a belly of bronze, and then the legs are iron and clay, kind of a succession of 4 kingdoms. And Nebuchadnezzar is told explicitly, you, O king, are the head of gold. So after you are going to come these other empires. Then in chapter 7, in a chapter that's largely parallel to chapter 2, and we can't go into the whole architectonic structure of the book of Daniel, but scholars who have done that have found a big chiasm there too. So chapter 7 corresponds to chapter 2. Here again, Daniel has a dream one night. It's not Nebuchadnezzar's dream this time, it's Daniel's own dream. And in the visions of the night, he says, I saw a beast rising out of the sea, very same image that John uses in the Apocalypse. First it's a lion, and then a bear, and then a leopard, and then this monster comes along that goes right after the people of God. In fact, it might be worth just keeping a finger in the book of Revelation and turning back to Daniel 7, because John draws heavily from Daniel 7 in our current chapter. And we'll just review a few of the high points here. So we've already talked about the succession of four empires. The interpretation of those four animals is given in Daniel 7:17. These four great beasts are four kings or kingdoms. A king represents a kingdom or an empire who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. But going back, let's look at the fourth beast in verse 7 and how it's described. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrible and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. That's where John gets the 10 horns from. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. Behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. It's a human being, but he speaks blasphemous things, claiming to be divine. Further down, Daniel is curious about this fourth beast. So in verse 19, now that he's talking with an angel and he's getting some interpretation, he says, I desired to know the truth concerning the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrible. So he describes it again, and concerning the 10 horns that were on its head. It had eyes, and it had a mouth that spoke great things. Verse 21, I looked, and this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. Then the angel speaks in verse 23. That's Daniel's question. How shall I understand this? The angel said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, different from all the others. It shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. Talks about the 10 horns, 10 kings are going to arise. And then another after them, he shall be different from the former ones. He'll put down three. He shall speak words against the Most High, Eliyah, in Aramaic, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. He shall think to change the times and the law. They shall be given into his hand for a time, two times, and half a time. There's this 3.5-year period of time. But the court will sit in judgment. His dominion shall be taken away. Saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom. Commentators on the book of Daniel universally point to an event in history in which that little horn, that final horn, acted. Namely, they point to the time of someone you may never have heard of, because we're all Protestants, and so we don't read the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They're found in the Old Testament Apocrypha. We don't consider them to be scripture. Nevertheless, for what they're worth, they are historical documents, and they tell us about a time in the early 100s BC when the Jewish people suffered persecution under Antiochus IV Epiphanes, a Seleucid king. The very name, Epiphanes, tells us that he claimed to be the epiphany or the appearance on earth of a god, a pagan god. In other words, he was a god incarnate, he thought. And he expected people to worship him. And so when he entered the land of the Jews and found that they worshiped only the one God of heaven, he was offended. And so he instigated secret police who would enter synagogues and homes, confiscate the Jewish scriptures. He had mothers put to death who allowed their sons to be circumcised. And he went right into the temple precincts themselves and built an altar to Zeus, the god of the Greeks, and took it upon himself to have his priests, whom he had appointed, offer pork on that altar in order to desecrate it from a Jewish point of view and sort of rub the noses of the Jews in the mud, so to speak. And so that's what these words are describing. The human being who speaks great things, who makes claims that are beyond what it's appropriate for a human being to make, who arrogates to himself worship, who even goes into the temple of the one God and there offers pagan sacrifices to the high god of the Greek pantheon. That's what Daniel is talking about in the case of this little horn in Daniel 7. Well, in chapter 8, the animal imagery changes. It's a little more focused chapter. We don't have four kingdoms there. It's just a conflict between the ram and the goat. But we're told, so I've lined them up where they seem to belong. There we're told in Daniel 8, verse 20, we have an angelic identification. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the he-goat is the king of Greece. That would be Alexander the Great, the Macedonian who conquered all of the known world, and Persia and Media as well. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. The great horn got broken, four kingdoms sprang forth. And then, once again, Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, is described in verse 23. At the latter end of their rule, when the transgressors have reached their full measure, a king of bold countenance, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great. He shall cause fearful destruction, shall succeed in what he does. He shall destroy mighty men and the people of the saints. By his cunning, he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind, he shall magnify himself. Without warning, he shall destroy many. He shall even rise up against the prince of princes, but by no human hand, he shall be broken. Now, I hesitate to touch on Daniel 9 and the prophecy there toward the end of Daniel 9, so I haven't even put it up on the board. But, you know, in the cycling nature of Daniel's prophecy, it's probably describing much the same set of events, the 70 weeks of years. But I just want to draw to our attention In the latter chapters of Daniel, then, beginning in 8:13, there's a key phrase that comes up again and again. This is in the description of Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, under the figure of the goat who has destroyed the ram of Persia. We're told, I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to the one that spoke, for how long is the vision concerning the continual burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate? Just let that phrase sink into your memory. The transgression that makes desolate. That's referring to a particular period. The years I've put on the board there, 167 to 164, those are not the years of the reign of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. His reign was longer than that. But those are the years, the three-year period, during which he had his pagan altar in the temple, desecrating the holiness of the temple that the Jews had built to God. Three-year period, almost exactly from day to day. Now, he had done other things in Israel before that, but that event, the deliberate desecration of the holy temple of God, is called in Daniel 8:13 the transgression that makes desolate. A key phrase comes up again in Daniel 9. Very last verse of that chapter, he shall make strong a covenant with many for 1 week, for half of the week, and here a week is a week of years, so it's a 3.5 year period, for half of the week he shall cause sacrifice and offering to cease. Well, that's exactly what Antiochus IV Epiphanes did. And upon the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate. Again, this language of desolation. Go over again with me to Daniel 11. Now, we certainly don't have time to follow through all the events of the intertestamental period that this chapter describes, kind of the ongoing feud between the king of the north and the king of the south. The north would be the Seleucid kings. The south would be the kings in Egypt who called themselves the Ptolemies. But again, we find this phrase in Daniel 11, verse 31. They shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. And one more time in Daniel 12, over in verse 11. From the time that the continual burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. Just notice, you know, details continue to proliferate. But just notice the phrase, the abomination of desolation, describing this key period of time. Time when a pagan usurper in Israel makes war against faithful Israel, specifically in the sense that he stops the holy sacrifices and institutes his own Greek sacrifices right in the temple. Now, all of that is going to feed into the image of the beast in Revelation 13. But before we get to Revelation 13, on the far left side of the board, I've just put up a list of a few other scriptures that John probably had at the back of his mind as he wrote this chapter under divine inspiration. So go with me back to Matthew, chapter 24, where Jesus talks about the outline of things that will happen toward the end of time as we know it. So at the beginning of Matthew 24, Jesus predicts the temple, all these beautiful buildings that his disciples observe. Herod's temple, one of the most beautiful buildings of antiquity. Verse 2, he says, truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. That actually happened in AD 70 when the Romans came in and destroyed the Jewish temple. and it's never been rebuilt ever since that time. But notice down in verse 15, the language that Jesus chooses to use. So when you see the desolating sacrilege spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So Jesus picks up this same phrase out of Daniel. When Daniel first wrote the book in its original historical context, he was referring to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. But now history has moved forward. The Seleucid Empire has been crushed by the Romans. And so as we move into the New Testament period, Palestine is now occupied by a kingdom beyond the ones that Daniel saw. Palestine is now occupied by Rome. And Jesus knows that about 40 years after his crucifixion, there's going to be a war between the Jews and the Romans. The Jews will rebel against their Roman overlords, AD 66 to 70. There was an outpost at Masada as late as about 73 or 74. So we say AD 70, just to pick a round number, is kind of the climactic time. And Jesus uses the language of Daniel's prophecy to describe that event. Typological use of Old Testament language. In other words, Jesus is saying the same kind of thing that Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did to the Jewish people, the Romans are going to do again. It's a different event in history, but theologically, it's the same kind of event that took place. And so one can use Daniel's language and apply it to what happened shortly after the time of Jesus. Actually, I skipped one. We should just touch in on 2 Thessalonians 2. We've referred to this a couple of times already. 2 Thessalonians 2, Paul's description, incorporating quite a bit of language from Daniel's prophecy. Beginning to read in 2 Thessalonians 2:3, let no one deceive you in any way. That day, namely the day of Christ's return, will not come unless the rebellion comes first. The apostasy comes first. And the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship. That comes right out of Daniel. So that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. And then Paul goes on to describe how the coming of this lawless one will be accompanied by deception and miracles and so forth, so as to deceive the dwellers on earth. Go to 1 John chapter 2, verse 18. Children, says the author, it is the last hour. And as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. Now, the only reason why I've brought this verse up is because it introduces into our discussion the term Antichrist. This is the place in the Bible where the term Antichrist is found. You don't actually find the word Antichrist anywhere in the book of Revelation. That comes as a surprise to some people, but if you doubt it, just find a good concordance, look up Antichrist, and you'll see there are no verses for it in the book of Revelation. Uh, So there are about three places in the epistles, 1st and 2nd John, where he uses the word Antichrist. There, however, in that context, he's actually describing some heretics who are speaking untrue things about Christ. He's not looking at a political figure like we have in the book of Revelation. But I think, you know, with a little bit of license, we can probably call the beast of the book of Revelation an appearance of an Antichrist figure. So go back then to Revelation 13:2, having looked in rapid fire fashion at Daniel. Let's read this verse once more. The beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, its mouth was like a lion's mouth. To it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. So in Daniel, these animals represented different empires, different kind of a succession in time of different kingdoms. In the book of Revelation, they all flow together into one big composite figure, as though this one is the last and the greatest that sums them all up in itself. But in the same way that Daniel 7 and Daniel 2 had to do with kingdoms, so also here in Revelation 13. So the picture so far is that there's this demonic being, the dragon, the devil and Satan, he's called in 12:9. But how does he work on earth? He has to have human agents through whom he works. And so he stands on the sand of the sea in Revelation 12:17, and out of the sea rises this beast, this big evil kingdom. That's going to be the instrument, the agent, by which the dragon works in the world. Just notice the parallel. Just pause for a moment. How does God work in the world? God also uses human agents. Who was the greatest of all God's agents? Well, his own son, whom he sent into the world to be the Messiah. What is the Messiah? Mashiach. He's the anointed king of Judah. And so in the same way that the true God works through Jesus as his earthly Messiah, so also the beast, so also the dragon who would like to rival God, demonic underworld source, works through a king of his choice. And who was the king of the world at the time when John addressed this letter to the seven churches of Asia? Well, the Roman emperor. He is the beast. We'll see further evidence for that as we go along. Verse 3, one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. So it would be nice to know exactly what that's referring to. All we can do for now is kind of lodge in our minds the idea that the beast has these seven heads, and one of those heads suffers a mortal wound but recovers. And this is wondrous enough that the earth follows after it. Is it talking about an individual ruler like Nero? Because we know there did come about, Nero was an awful ruler. Nobody liked him. He did okay for the first 5 years, the golden quinquennium. But once he had the philosopher Seneca take poison, instructing him to commit suicide. No longer being advised by a wise man, Nero began to show his true colors, and he became tyrannical, had people killed left and right. Nero was also remembered as the first of the Roman emperors who went after the Christians, persecuted them, and tortured them in the most awful ways in the years, kind of in the mid-60s, following a great fire in Rome. He blamed the Christians for starting the fire, had many of them put to death. But after Nero had died, you know, he had been such a horrific ruler. There were some people, lots of people, who feared maybe he isn't dead. Maybe the stories we've heard that he died are untrue. Maybe he's going to come back. And so the so-called Nero Redivivus myth took a number of different forms. Maybe he just swooned and he's going to come back, or maybe he really did die and he's going to revive from the dead. Unfortunately, though, all the forms that we have of the Nero Redivivus myth date from a time considerably later than when John was writing. So whether that's what he's referring to, there's a possibility, but it's a little bit doubtful. So this wounded head that comes back to life, is it an individual ruler like Nero? Or is it just kind of a big principle that tells us, you know, evil of this sort has a tendency to keep popping up in different places in history? Well, we've already seen it happen to the Jews in the 160s BC under Antiochus IV Epiphanes. It happened again in AD 70 between the Jews and the Romans. And now it's happening again in the 90s as Domitian is emperor. Is it just a big symbol for the resilience of this kind of evil in the world? I think, again, we just have to leave that as kind of an open question. One of the tantalizing things about the way John uses language is that sometimes it's hard to pin down exactly what he's referring to. Let's read on a bit. So the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. People worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" Notice in that verse two occurrences of the word worship. People worshiped the beast. But then, much like we just read in the book of Daniel, verse 5, the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words. It was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. There's our 3.5-year period. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. Well, this language is just almost lifted out of a verse in Daniel 7, the image of war. In its first historical context, there was an actual war. Jews took up arms against Antiochus Epiphanes, and he sent his armies in to resist them. And that language of war is now taken up to describe the beast as it was used back in 11:7. This little kind of outline, this little foreshadowing that we had earlier in the book of Revelation, the beast that ascends from the bottomless pit will make war upon the two witnesses and conquer them and kill them. Authority was given it, back to Revelation 13:7, over every tribe and people and tongue and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. And then we get this exhortation, a call for faith and a call for endurance. Well, this is because John saw what zeal for the Roman emperor was already beginning to do to the churches in Asia. Go back once more to Revelation chapter 2, and let's reread what's said to the church at Pergamum early on in the book. Revelation 2, verse 13, words of comfort from the risen Christ to the church at Pergamum. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. Now, we just heard a reference to the throne of the dragon in Revelation 13, 2. You hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. So it looks as though at least one early Christian has maybe been lynched by a rioting crowd zealous for the glory of the emperor. After all, Pergamum, we didn't say this when we were looking at the letters or the oracles to the churches, but Pergamum was the place where the first temple was built to the living emperor. For the specific worship of Caesar Augustus, 29 BC, the first temple built in Asia to honor the living emperor as a divine being. So if we had time this morning, we don't, we would talk about the appearance in history of the imperial cult, the requirement that people worship the living emperor, something that came in the 90s in Asia with a vengeance. So it's in that kind of social context that John says, here's a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Are we going to call Caesar Lord, or are we going to worship God alone? That becomes the great question of faithfulness for these churches. And let's just pause and think. How about in our day? Are there any Christians who face a similar choice? Those of you who know German, you've probably seen the black and white filming from World War II, where thousands of people would gather in a square in Berlin or somewhere else in Germany. They'd raise their hands and they would say, Heil Hitler. What does Heil mean, those of you who know German? Yeah, Heilig means holy, and Heil has to do with salvation. Hitler is our savior. Under Stalin, under Lenin, in Russia, 10 million Christians imprisoned, tortured, executed. The rule of Idi Amin, the rule of Pol Pot. Just look around the world today with persecution rising. The beast had a wound in its head, but it sprang back to life. It keeps getting destroyed, keeps popping up somewhere else. Just something to put in our pot and think about. I think we won't take time to read the whole of the rest of chapter 13, but one more beast comes out of the earth, and it tries to get people to worship the first beast. It probably represents the priests of the imperial cult. Maybe we'll find time next week to talk about this, but I do want to give a brief comment on verse 18. This calls for wisdom. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. So what shall we make of 666? There's an unholy trinity in this book. Not the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, but the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. We're told that it takes a little bit of wisdom to reckon the number of the beast. Does this mean that we're supposed to find a name, whether it's back in antiquity or in our own day, where you can add up the numerical value of the letters and they're supposed to add up to 666? Well, that's one way it's often taken. But there's another possibility that appeals to me, at least, because it says explicitly in verse 18, it's a human number. In other words, the whole point of this number is that the beast is not God. He's not worthy of worship. What happened on the sixth day of creation? God said, "Let us make man in our image." And the name of this beast, dragon, beast, and false prophet, is 666. Isn't that maybe the point that John is trying to drive home? He's only human. Don't worship him. Well, we're 5 minutes over. We better call her quits. We'll see you next week.